Hey there, this is the Hello Personality Podcast, the place where you'll learn how to use your personality type to live a radically authentic life that ignites your potential and creates positive ripple effects for all of those around you. I'm Leslie McDaniel, and this is Season 4, Episode 5. This episode marks the beginning of the heart type interviews for our series on the intersection of the Enneagram and emotional intelligence. We'll meet our first heart type guest in just a moment, a type 2, but let's do a quick refresher about this type and the heart center in general before we get to that interview. All heart center types, and this includes 2s, 3s, and 4s, primarily experience the world through their relationships and their relationship to their emotions, either their own or others. Now, this means that their understanding of the world comes through having an emotional read on people or situations. And they also need to feel like they are connecting with someone in order to understand things or to be understood. All heart center types have unique struggles with the core emotion of sadness. Now, some will call this grief due to a real or perceived loss or even shame, but I believe sadness is more accurate. Heart types aren't always outwardly emotional, and they don't always know what their own emotions are. That can be true, but it may not be true for all heart types all of the time. The emotional passion of type 2 is called pride, and the antidote for pride is humility. This is the virtue for type 2s, and it comes from the higher emotional center. If you're unfamiliar with what a passion and a virtue is, you can check out Season 2, Episode 3, in which I go through the passions and the virtues of all 9 types. So our Type 2 guest is Darby Davenport. Darby has spent her career working with leaders, teams, and organizations in a variety of ways to build capability, enhance leadership consciousness, and increase overall health and performance. She is deeply committed to developing passionate, insightful, and authentic leaders who evoke excellence, commitment, and innovation from those around them. Darby has been studying and using the Enneagram as a transformative development tool for many years, and it has become an important part of her work with both individuals and teams. Now, I initially met Darby virtually through an Enneagram group that was started by a mutual friend, whom you'll actually get to meet in the Type 6 interview in a few weeks. But then Darby and I met in person at an Enneagram Inner Work Retreat hosted by CP Enneagram Academy. We continue to be involved in a really in-depth inner growth group that formed after one of these retreats. So I have the privilege of being able to interact with Darby and support her and have her support on our mutual growth paths. Darby's subtype is self-preservation type 2, which is the countertype for 2s. So she's going to talk about some things that are a little bit different than what you might think of a stereotypical 2 response. I didn't point this out during the type 8 and 9 interviews, but they were also countertypes as well. A countertype is a subtype that kind of goes against the natural flow of the passion of the type in certain ways. So the self-preservation 2, for example, is going to be a little less out there with their desire to help others. They're going to be a little more focused on themselves and their own survival, but still using the type 2 patterns to get what they feel are missing, which is love and approval and acceptance. This season, we're talking about the intersection of the Enneagram and emotional intelligence, including each type's strengths and struggles when it comes to personal competence, which includes self-awareness and self-management, and social or relational competence, which includes social awareness and social management. If you want more information about all these aspects of emotional intelligence, be sure to check out episode 1 of this season where I go into more detail. So as you listen to my conversation with Darby, notice her relationship to these various aspects of emotional intelligence. I will point some of them out, but see if you can pick up other connections. As with all of our guests, Darby has put herself in a very vulnerable position of sharing her growth journey with us, so I want to make sure that we honor that and her willingness to share her life, her growth, and her struggles with us. Whether or not you're a type 2, use this interview to not only notice patterns between the type 2 and the various aspects of emotional intelligence, but also use this conversation as a mirror to learn about yourself. We all have some aspects of each type within us. Our type is just generally identified by the passion that we struggle with the most. And Darby and I are going to talk a little bit about how the passion may not be the most obvious part of your type that you notice first. As you listen, tune into what you can learn from your body, your heart, and your mind. Okay, I'll be back at the end to add a few more thoughts to our conversation, but let's go ahead and dive in with Darby. Hey, Darby, welcome to the Hello Personality podcast. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this with me.
Oh, thank you for having me, Leslie.
You're welcome.
It's good to be here.
Yeah, I know it's not the easiest thing for people to choose to open themselves up in this way. So it really means a lot, even though I know we know each other in our regular life. It means a lot that you've chosen to be here.
Yes, thank you. Yes, I definitely had the pause around whether or not to jump in. It is a scenario or a experience that I'd be happy to let somebody else fill in. But at the same time, it's a good practice for me to have these sorts of opportunities to share and discuss. And of course, I adore you, and I think this podcast is wonderful. So it's fun to be a part of it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I think it shows a lot of awareness for people who, you know, I've had a previous guest, our type nine guest, talked about that, about recognizing some of your patterns coming up as you're deciding whether or not to say yes, and then choosing to go for it anyway, as a way to maybe deconstruct some of those patterns.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I wanted to just kind of jump in and start with your introduction to the Enneagram. Like, how did you find it? Were you interested in self-growth first, or was it the Enneagram? Yeah, I'm curious how that came about for you.
Yeah, for me, it was actually work. It was professional first. I was working internally in an organization, in an organization development role, and a colleague of mine had been exposed to Enneagram and suggested that we bring it in to do work with the leadership teams we were supporting as a tool for both leader development, but also team development. So my real early introduction felt much more pragmatic and practical and more other focused. Of course, as always, when you are in the world of personality assessments, it's fascinating to learn about yourself as well. But the focus of attention for me was much more on how I use this tool to support the development of others in the beginning. Yeah. And that was maybe 10 years ago or so now, maybe even a little longer. And, you know, kind of the first, I would say, 4 years or so was really in that vein. Me learning enough about the Enneagram and its applications in the workplace and in the leader and team settings to be a facilitator of that learning.
Yeah. That makes sense for a two. Like, oh, this is a tool I can use to help other people.
Yes.
How long after that introduction did it take you to find your own type?
Yeah. I found my own type fairly soon in that introduction. I think that was part of winning me over, if you will. Mm-hmm. And at the time, however, the process for me finding my type was the one I pursued was using an online assessment that its accuracy was, you know, questionable, I guess I would say.
Yeah.
And, you know, what it did is provide us with, you know, the top three contenders and gave you a sense of likeliness, you know, or emphasis. But at the same time, I spent quite a while, probably quite some number of years actually not being 100% certain I was a two. Mm. My other two high scores were 7 and 9. And I really did see ways in which each of those were possible, potential. Mm-hmm. So while I was, you know, kind of leaning towards two for most of that time, there were moments of, I might be a 9. This sounds very familiar, you know, mm-hmm. or I might be a 7. So it did take me probably two to three years to feel fairly, well, I would say maybe 100%, you know, grounded in the two as my type. And actually, to be honest, I think what really solidified it for me was the learning of subtypes, because mm-hmm. it wasn't initially that I was learning subtypes. And when I started working with BeachSNet and learning about subtypes, it became far more clear to me.
Yeah. Yeah. As a counter type, as a self-preservation mm-hmm. too, it can be, yeah, it can be a little difficult for all counter types, I think, to find their type.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. But I was curious. Sorry. Did you have something else to add?
No, go ahead.
Yeah. I was curious which aspects of the 7 and the 9, I'm assuming it's more mm-hmm. the behavioral things, which aspects did you resonate with? And it's kind of a two-part question. The other part is, what beyond the subtype, what aspects of two solidified that for you? That, nope, I'm mm-hmm. not the 7, not a 9. Yeah.
Yeah. So with the 7, the part I really related to was the positivity, which mm-hmm. frankly, all 2 7s and 9s all orient themselves around that. Mm-hmm. But the positivity and the reluctance to really spend much time in the negative or in the mm-hmm. in the darker emotions. So I definitely resonated with that. I also saw myself as somebody who loved adventure and loved spontaneity, mm-hmm. and I didn't like to lock into plans. Like, I felt much more comfortable in the space of leaving things open. Mm-hmm. And so there were some of those elements that didn't, you know, that really did speak to me. And then I'll speak to the 9, and then I'll maybe come back to what ultimately swayed me. Mm-hmm. So for the 9, avoidance of conflict, having a hard time setting boundaries, saying no, those to me are things that oftentimes 2s and 9s share.
Yeah.
A little bit more of a reserved nature. And again, the kind of positive or seeing the best, non-judgmental, nice. And I identified with some of those things as well.
Yeah.
For the 7, I think when I really got to understand more about the 7, there's an assertiveness and an avoidance of the kind of pain and discomfort that I didn't fully identify with. I mean, there were elements of that, but, you know, it's almost sometimes more helpful to me to look at the challenging side, the shadow side of the type. And it was more of the recognition that what I was seeing most about myself was more of the positive, the upsides of that type. So when I connected with my own preferences around or where I get stuck in my life is maybe a better way of putting it. It was not so much in the 7s, 7 stuff. And likewise with the 9, you know, sometimes the disconnection and or the tendency to move more slowly or to in some ways quietly rebel, again, to me, didn't feel quite like where I was getting stuck. Mm-hmm. So, and then when I learned about self-preservation too, I began to see some of the tendency to step back a bit more, to, you know, in other words, let others drive, if you will, mm-hmm. As very much consistent with the self-preservation subtype. So that felt more clear. Mm-hmm. And also with this kind of mixed feelings about helping or being connected with others, like, and that it, not all twos are stereotypical givers or, I remember when I first learned about twos, I'm like, I am not a very good gift giver. Like, I forget people's birthdays and I never remember to bring stuff back from trips and adventures. And so many others are more thoughtful around those things. So there was this like, I can't be a two orientation because so much emphasis, especially back then, was on this giving element, which I think is now much more nuanced and explained in a much more broad or diverse way. But at that time, I was having a hard time connecting with that. And so once I began to understand a little bit more about the two and the desire to be of value through being helpful, supportive, mm-hmm. attentive, that began to hook me a bit more.
Yeah. And gaining your value from how other people feel about you, your status with them. Is that what you're saying? Yeah,
exactly. And by being a supportive and reliable friend, coworker, person in their lives, you know, and that I really got a lot of, I really invested a lot in that way of behaving, way of being, for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that sometimes it's easier for you to look at like the shadow of the type. And mm-hmm. I think that, you know, often the passion of the type is in our shadow initially.
Oh,
and
yes.
So the passion of seven, gluttony, the passion of nine, sloth, the passion of pride for twos. Was that something that helped you to distinguish as well? Like there seems like there'd be real clear differences beyond the things that you described. Was that also helpful or is that something that came later?
I think it came later because I think that the passion is, at least in my experience, the passion is hard to see.
Yeah.
And I did not connect with pride. In fact, I felt almost the exact opposite, especially as a self-pres too. Mm-hmm. I had, you know, spent my career being told, for example, that I needed to stand in my power more, be more, take charge, be a little bit more assertive, you know, and all of these, in some ways in my head represented a version of pride, like a version of, if I really believe in myself, I will do those things. And I actually felt like it was in some ways the opposite. So I remember it was not until I was really doing some deeper inner work that I began to see pride and its many nuances and many faces. And that was much later, after I had landed that I was a two.
Yeah.
So that didn't help me as much. But that was me, partly maybe the counter type at play.
Yeah, there. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's really helpful though for people to understand that
yes,
that may not be the first piece that you're like, oh yeah, that's exactly my struggle.
I think
I think we tend to, you know, we can relate to all the types in some way or another.
Yes.
But with the passion of our type, that tends to be the one we struggle with the most. You know, we can experience the other passions, of course, but the place where we find ourselves located on the Enneagram is the one that is kind of the deepest struggle. So it makes sense that even if it's, even if there are some elements of it that are visible, that there probably are, there's probably a whole lot that's in our shadows. At least that's been my experience. And from other people I've worked with, it can, elements of it can show itself over time as we do our work.
Yes, exactly. And even sneak in places where you feel like you're being the opposite or doing the opposite.
Yes.
Like, so for me, there was like this almost a pride in being humble.
Yeah.
Which in and of itself is, the shadow at play, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. You talked about a type 7, you know, having that avoidance of pain and discomfort, and you didn't really relate to that fully. And so I'm curious, just as a little bit of a segue into, you know, the core emotion that all heart types struggle with is sadness. Some other people call it grief at loss, or some people call it shame. I tend to say sadness. But I'm curious, what have you learned about, or what have you become aware about your relationship to sadness specifically?
Yeah. Well, I'll just start with the fact that as a 2, I would say that my relationship with any of my feelings is a little bit, unfamiliar in general.
Yeah. Okay.
And, so let me just say that, like, before I get into answering your question, which is that my pattern of navigating emotions as I experience them is tends to be either push them away, I don't want to feel them, or solve them, like make them go away by solving, like resolving a conflict or resolving a something that's making me sad or whatever it might be. Right. So I remember when I was first learning the Enneagram and I was working with my colleague who had brought this in, and there was a scenario where we'd been in this meeting and we'd come out of it and she was furious and and it was like, I didn't even, and was furious and believed that there was a reason for me to be mad. In other words, there was a way it unfolded that I was somehow kind of blamed for something that was not appropriate. And it was like, it didn't even occur to me to be angry. I needed somebody else to tell me that I should be. And then all of a sudden I could feel it, you know, and all of a sudden I could connect with it. But it was an interesting example, I guess, of how my focus of attention is so often outside of me around how others are doing, what they're saying, what's happening, how to take care of them in some way. And that it almost takes somebody else telling me that I should be angry or sad for me to connect with that. Now I think I'm doing a lot better now, but I would just say in general, my relationship to emotions is a little bit disconnected for most of my life. As it relates to sadness, I think it's a similar pattern of, I think it, first of all, it often gets disguised as something else. So in other words, it might get disguised as fear or irritation or frustration or some version of anger. And it's only after kind of digging into that and peeling it away that I kind of realize that it's sadness underneath. So it can be sneaky that way. And then I also think that I do a pretty good job of not wanting to live in my sadness. So not good probably, but a good job of in some ways not spending time in it, compartmentalizing, setting it aside, whatever it might be, in order to get on with things, get on with life, especially if it's something that I don't feel like there's something to be done about it, right? So So it's an interesting relationship because while I know sadness is underlying so much of my emotional landscape, I know that now. I don't think I knew that as I was entering into the world of inner work and the world of Enneagram. And so I relate to it far more now than I ever have. But in the beginning, not so much.
Yeah. It's interesting. You pointed out how your awareness of it often needs to come through other people. And before you said that, I noticed you'd said like something that's making me sad. Like it was almost like this outer referencing of like the emotions are coming from outside.
Yeah. It's so true. And that's how it feels often. It does feel like my emotions when I have them are coming from outside. Now, I know that that's often not the case, but that is the story I think I have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just, as I was listening, I was just contrasting to myself. And, you know, like for me, I think I've had to learn to think about like, where is this sadness coming from? Like, what is it that is impacting my emotions right now? Because I feel sad. I am sad. Like that is the thing. That's my initial thought rather than it coming from outside. So I think that's just a contrast there for the four and the two perspective on where it's coming from.
Yes.
So in that story you just shared about the other person kind of like helping you see that you needed to be angry or this was a appropriate time to be angry, if you will. I'm curious, what is your relationship to other people and their emotions? Like, are you able to, do you deal well when other people show big, strong emotions? How do you manage that? I'm curious about your social awareness and your social management.
Yes. I feel like I have a two-part answer to that. I feel very attuned to the nuances of others' emotions, way more than my own. And I mean, to be fair, it's also in some ways part of my work to be in working with teams in particular and facilitating team discussions. There's a way in which really kind of tuning into the emotional landscape, not just what's being said or not said. So it's on my mind all the time, but I also think it's something that comes fairly easily or readily for me. So I do feel tuned in. What I have a bit of a different answer for is the big emotions, and my comfort is, this is something I think I've been working at, but it's hard for me because I don't have them so readily. And there is particularly big emotions when they're tied to anger. Well, frankly, any of the big ones, like anger or fear or sadness, like any of those. But anger in particular, I have a hard time. The first thing I want to do is solve it, fix it, make it go away, versus really kind of allowing that to bring forth the insights and the wisdom and the understanding that might come from that place. But I do believe that part of that discomfort is also coming from many of us are not very well equipped or well-versed at navigating big emotions in ways that don't, or in ways that are what I want to think of as constructive or not destructive.
Yeah, that's the word I was thinking as well.
And I think, how do we, so part of my discomfort is in the navigating the impact of that, whether it's on me or frankly, even more so when it's on others, and wanting to somehow manage the destructive nature. And, you know, this is where perhaps pride comes in this belief that I'm supposed to manage it or that it's on me or that I can, you know, in some ways make it better or make it more constructive, et cetera. But it is something that's kind of my impulsive reaction. For sure.
As you were talking about experiencing big emotions from other people, I was wondering if, do you think that your self-preservation nature is at play? I know you said it's often for like managing the impact of on others, but you know, sometimes when I think about experiencing big emotions from other people, like anger particularly is big for me. If I experience a lot of anger, then I feel like you were saying, there's that destructive nature, like, oh, this could go bad. So I was wondering for you, does your self-preservation nature play into that? Maybe fear around what could happen to you in the face of these big emotions from others?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both the two and the self-preservation. Mm. It's like a double whammy because the self-preservation, absolutely, there is this like fear of the my ability, if you will, to take, you know, kind of to take care of self, etc. But I also think it's this fear of losing my relationship with this other person, which to me is very much the two. And if they, I mean, ultimately, will they still like me or love me after all this, you know? And that feels incredibly vulnerable, especially in the moment, in the heat of the energy of the emotion. And so, you know, I can get quickly into the, especially if it's just between me and one other person, into the role of sacrificing myself for the, you know, in the interest of resolving the conflict. And, you know, so I'm learning now to pay a lot more attention to that, and to recognize that I have a voice, if you will, in the navigating of what happens next. But I don't think I would say most of my life, I've not had much awareness on that. It's more of how do I make this go away quickly? And that might mean sacrificing my needs or wants in order to do so.
So would you say that compulsion to make it okay, make it go away, is a sense of like, then I will feel like I'm okay here. I'm loved still by this person. We're still connected. All of those things, those two patterns.
And then, and if I think the fear is if I advocate for myself too much or ask for too much or whatever my story is around those things, that then I might lose that, that the relationship might be sacrificed in some way.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I'm curious how does that work then also with, like, a lot of times we hear about the self-preservation too. At least Beatrice Chestnut talks about it being childlike and having a sense of like wanting to be taken care of or having a, so I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about those patterns and how that relates.
Yes. I find that such a, what's the right word? I'm trying to think of the right word, the right term.
Like a dichotomy or?
Yes, thank you, the dichotomy. I see such a dichotomy here around this childlike persona that I do identify with. But at the same time, this self-preservation instinct also really holds this fierce independence. And so there's this way in which I kind of long, I would say I long for, to be, I long to be taken care of, but I also at the same time don't know that I'd ever allow it because there's this belief and this attitude that it's my role to take care of myself and frankly, others too. And so
just
my orientation is to like, I don't want to depend on anybody else. I'm going to take care of myself. And while I'm at it, I'm going to take care of you too. And so it's a weird push-pull. Like I want it, but I don't think I mean, I might allow it here and there, but not in the way that you might imagine a child feeling the kind of somewhat needy and needing care, right?
Yeah.
At the same time, I do think the way I operate in the world and around certain things can be perceived and probably is somewhat naive, and then almost invites somebody to step in and help or protect or guide. And it's probably only in certain categories of my life, but like, for example, I'm definitely not handy around fixing anything around the house. And I feel very childlike in that sphere of my life. And I'm kind of okay with that. But at the same time, it means that a lot of things don't get done because I'm not going to go figure it out. And it'll take until I actually hire somebody or bring somebody in, or somebody from my friend, my community says, oh, I can help with that. So it's an interesting dichotomy. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think some of the maybe lack of assertiveness that you talked about earlier might come into play here too, of kind of,
yes.
And you tell me if it resonates with you, but maybe a sitting back in some ways to see, will yes. the solution arise? Will someone come and figure this out for me?
Exactly. And I secretly want them to, but I don't want to have to ask. And I've gotten way better at asking, but I still see that pattern of not wanting to be the one to have to deal with X or fix Y or whatever it might be. And
yes. So you've mentioned a couple times, like you weren't aware of that before, but you are now. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious for the person who's listening, like if they're a two or if they know twos or even just in their own work, like how did you become aware of those things? How did you begin to understand there is this dichotomous nature to your strict, your super independence and also wanting to be taken care of, or that there actually was pride in certain ways when you felt the opposite a lot of times? How did you become aware?
A lot of inner work, and that takes many forms. So I've done quite a lot of work, excuse me, in retreat settings. Certainly with Bea Chestnut and Ronnie Pius, like that has been a pretty pivotal, life-changing series of work, for sure. Therapy, lots of therapy. And I think for me anyway, it's like, you know, with each layer that I, you know, kind of revealed, there was even more curiosity about wanting to understand more. So in the beginning, I would say that didn't really exist for me. There was, you know, I believed that understanding my two-ness gave me some insight to the way I operated in the world and the way that I struggled in the world, and that there was some work I could do to kind of focus in on some of the struggles. But I don't think it was until I started on that work with Bea and Oranio that I really understood the depth of kind of peeling back these layers and patterns and understanding self that the Enneagram offered in some way. For me, it was really through the lens of the Enneagram, although frankly, it doesn't necessarily have to be. It was certainly a helpful tool for me in this process.
Yeah.
But just the investment in wanting to understand and know myself in a different way feels like at the heart of it.
Yeah.
I do remember, I also went through an executive coaching program, and at the very beginning, actually at a prerequisite before I even signed up, there was the teacher had talked about the fact that in order to be an effective executive coach, effective coach of any kind, you need to be doing your own work, and that's not an easy journey. And, you know, it requires a big investment. And I remember in that moment going, I'm not sure I want to do this. I'm good. Yeah. I mean, I honestly was like, I'm good. My life is fine. Like, I don't have a strong need to go down that road. And I'm not sure what convinced me to do it. I think probably some amount of being fairly naive, but I'm so grateful I did. And I had no idea of what, you know, what I would discover in that process. Yeah. And I just come back to that statement of I'm good, I'm fine, I don't need to do that is pride, you know, pride right there, for example. And this desire to kind of stay in the comfortable, not go to the uncomfortable, was very much the self-pres too in action. So it was fun.
Yeah. You said you were naive. Does that mean you just got kind of sucked into it?
Some ways. I mean, the good thing is once I did, there was a desire for more. I mean, I could have stayed, and many do, much more on the surface. Yeah. I think there's a lot of work to do that can be really valuable that doesn't necessarily go as deep.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, a path that I could have stayed on, I think, and many do, and still been incredibly valuable to me.
Yeah.
So it was fair. I did kind of fall into it. And I think I stayed in it because of, definitely would not say fun, but the discovery process and the learning process and the growth process felt very worth it in the end, for sure.
It sounds, you know, going back to what you originally started with, you were solutions oriented around it. Like, I've got a few things here. I'm just going to solve these problems. Or, you know, maybe you said your life was good initially, but then you saw, okay, maybe I can work on this and that. But then it morphed into, I think you used the word curiosity and seeing the depth. And I found that true for my life and other people that I've talked to. It's almost like a window is opened and you just can't help but look. Like, you want to see what else is there. Of course, coming from a four perspective, but I think that curiosity does serve anyone who wants to be on a growth path. Like, it serves so well because if you're just willing to be curious, there's so much to learn and discover. And you reference the fact that there's a lot more depth to the Enneagram or to this inner work than you realized. And I've had other guests, other interviewees say the same thing. And I'm curious, how would you distinguish, like, what is the depth that is available versus what you might see a lot of, like, Instagram posts, for example, or, you know, some more surface work that can be helpful, but it's not the core of what's available to us.
Yeah, I think that's, I think it's a really good question. And I have a thought. I'm guessing there are many more thoughts that could contribute to your question. But
yours is the important one that we're asking right now.
It is. Yeah, exactly. And I think it's just one lens, I guess, is my point.
Yeah, I understand.
My sense is that it kind of, if you think about the emotional intelligence quadrants, it definitely gets at this ability to regulate. So self-awareness is incredibly valuable, and I think a big piece of what Enneagram might offer. But the deeper understanding of why we do what we do and what is motivating that, and what we're in many ways afraid of or making up in our rationalizations, etc., allows us to decide how to respond. So as we begin to really understand that in a deeper way, I think we have a lot more choice We have a lot more ability to regulate the kind of ups and downs and challenges of life. We begin to be much more of a witness to ourselves in ways that I certainly wasn't before. You're four, so that might have been a different experience for you, but for me, definitely not. And so there is just a wealth of and somewhat never ending depth of discovery, and life kind of serves up what it serves up, and we get to, I think, be more well resourced in how we respond to the many ups and downs that are inevitable. So that's what, you know, to me, one really important piece. I also just think, for me as a two, that I was living my life very much at the surface. So to me, the other opportunity of depth in my life, and this may not be the case for all types, but for me, it has offered a very different set of relationships, a different experience in those relationships that I didn't even realize I was missing. Because I felt very connected. I think I was very connected in a very important way to those that meant a lot to me in my life. So that's, you know, I wouldn't change that, but I don't think I understood the opportunity that my own depth or that, you know, spending time in my own depths and discovering in that process how that might change the nature of my relationships with some both new and old friends. Yeah. So to me, that's another piece.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like you talked about the four quadrants of emotional intelligence. I feel like you covered them all there. It's almost like, and they are stair steps, like the self-awareness leads to the ability to manage yourself better. And then both of those are critical to developing your ability to be more aware and manage relationships in a better, more effective, healthy, connected way. So it all relates. And I love you just basically described all of that right there.
That's,
yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And I think that if you and I would have had this conversation 10 years ago, when I was first discovering Enneagram, I did see myself as having high EQ. And I do believe in many ways I did.
Yeah.
So what's interesting to me is with the work that I've done in deepening my self-awareness and my resource in the self-regulation way, it has brought new opportunity to, like you said, navigate the social and relationship, that those the other parts that were already important to me in new and deeper ways. And I think I didn't understand how my more cursory self-awareness and self-regulation was limiting me.
Ah, yeah.
In some way.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Yeah. I think, you know, I mentioned this in the introduction episode to this series for this season that most people do think they're more emotionally intelligent than they actually are. And, you know, we might look at other people who we disagree with or don't like and label them as less emotionally intelligent for whatever reason. But when you really get into it, as you said, it's similar to the understanding of our personality patterns. There's so much more to it. And increasing our level of emotional intelligence, as we've been talking about, really does have ripple effects, not only in our lives, but in the lives of other people too. And it's like, you don't know what you don't know until you know it. So being able to peek out that window that we were talking about and just having that willingness to look around the corner and see what might be there could reap so many benefits that that we're not even aware of if we're not willing to look.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it's interesting because to me, self-awareness in some ways has a couple of lenses one of which I think I was doing pretty well in, which is I'm very aware of my impact on others. I'm aware of how I'm operating in the world and navigating from here out, you know, in some way. What I don't think I really was very self-aware in the sense of knowing myself. And again, this comes to the two-ish orientation to be so other focused of what's happening inside of me at any given moment and why, or what is underneath this kind of, you know, what's, I think what's the bodily sensations? What are the kind of emotional, what's the emotional territory? And what is, how do I get to know and know, how do I know the nuances of what's happening for me? That, like, kind of studying myself in my everyday interactions versus studying you in our interactions was just such a different orientation. And so, I mean, I still feel like that's a big part of my journey forward, but it's been a lot different, and it has opened a whole new way of operating in the, my life for sure. And in my relationships. So,
I think, you know, what you're speaking to seems to be like there are different levels of self-awareness. Like there are different ways to look at it, different ways to be aware. And again, broadening the scope of that shows us that there's maybe some things that we're missing, maybe some things that we're not as aware of as we might like to think we are. Speaking from personal experience, you know? And also the fact that, you know, you brought in your body, there are with the Enneagram, those different centers of intelligence. And we have three different centers to provide us with knowledge about ourselves. And that's work that we can do too, in our self-awareness realm of what is our body telling us? What are our gut instincts telling us? What is our head rationally, logically telling us? Not just what is our heart showing us, you know, am I connected? Am I not connected? Do people love me? Do people not love me? Like those types of things that, that heart types are often focused on. Well, Darby, thank you so much for sharing so much of your life and wisdom and knowledge about yourself and the Enneagram with us. Is there any last words that you want to say, anything that you didn't get to say that came up, or any thoughts that you might want to share with other twos?
No, not that I can think of. It's been my pleasure. And I think I just encourage any twos, but frankly, anyone of any type, to invest in this process of exploration and learning and understanding, as it, I think, no matter what the experience is, has only upsides for our well-being and life path going forward. So, so thank you for inviting me to do this with you, but also for offering this to the world. I think it's very special.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate you saying yes, and I appreciate you being here. All right. Well, take care.
All right. Thanks, Leslie.
All right. So what new things did you discover about type twos in my conversation with Darby? Did you hear anything surprising from the self-preservation two that you may have thought, oh, I didn't realize a two could be like that? Now, I did point out some connections to emotional intelligence, but what new connections did you notice maybe that I didn't point out? What were Darby's strengths and struggles related to her self-awareness and her ability to manage herself, or her social awareness and management? I loved how upfront Darby was with the ways that she initially used the Enneagram and how she first used it for other people before turning it on herself. And as she did her work, how she was able to discover the depth of what was available to her, and not just to her, but her relationships. You know, she mentioned that she thought her relationships were okay. She thought her life was okay, only to find out the beauty and the depth that was available to her once she did some of her own inner work and became more self-aware of her own patterns and motivations. and how she saw that translating into deeper connections in her relationships. Now that you've heard interviews with almost half of the Enneagram types talking about their own strengths and struggles related to their type and their emotional intelligence, one thing they all have in common is that they either took courses or attended retreats or worked with coaches or invested in growth groups. I can't remember if we talked about that in each interview, but I know it's true for every single one of these people. This means that they took time to focus on their growth and to discover what they couldn't see about themselves, which has helped them to become more self-aware. This awareness helped them to better manage themselves as well. And both of these things, their self-awareness and self-management, are the foundation to build better, stronger, more connected relationships through having more social awareness and social management. So coming up in the next episode, we'll meet our next Heart Center guest, who is a type 3. I'll see you then. Take care.